Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii. Draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Good morning. Call the case, please.
Case number 27719, State v. Hinton. Arguing for the petitioner, Karen Nakasone. Arguing for the respondent, James Anderson. Arguing on the merits.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Public Defender Karen Nakasone on behalf of Petitioner Appellee Marshall Hinton. May it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you. This case concerns two issues with the IC majority's opinion in this case. First, whether the IC majority correctly stated the applicable law here, and secondly, whether that law was correctly applied by the IC majority. The ICA majority gravely erred in its statement of the applicable law in this jurisdiction concerning hung jury trial dismissals. It incorporated a novel separation of powers considerations which we contend conflict with and undermine longstanding precedent in this jurisdiction. And that was clear grave error. The second grave error we raise is that the ICA majority erred in concluding ultimately that the trial court abused its discretion when it dismissed the case under State v. Moriwaki. The IC majority, in effect, applied a de novo standard of review and said that the trial court was wrong. A right-wrong standard was applied, saying that the trial court was wrong in how it assessed and weighed certain factors within the six-factor Moriwaki framework. And in doing so, the IC majority disregarded the clear caution in Moriwaki to, quote, accord deference, end quote, to the trial court's decision. Before I begin the substantive portion of the argument, I'd like to thank this court for the opportunity to be heard on this very important case regarding the judicial power to dismiss. It is vital for the IC majority to be given clarification on what Moriwaki is and is not. It is important for the trial courts to be reassured that their discretionary decisions are not going to be second-guessed or sliced and diced on appeal. And it is crucial that the trial courts that there be no chilling effect on the trial courts anytime they decide to exercise their discretion against wishes of the prosecution. First, to turn to the first point, which is to clarify for the benefit of the IC majority what the applicable law is in this jurisdiction. Moriwaki is a framework, it's not a test. Moriwaki specifically states that the trial courts must always be balancing the three competing interests, the competing interests of the court, of the state, and of the defendant. And while they're doing this balancing, they then should apply the six factors in considering whether to dismiss or not. So it's a framework, it's not a test. A test is something that's like a formulaic analysis. A plus B, if you have A, B, and C, then it's D. It's not a right-wrong type of analysis. In fact, Moriwaki even says that the trial court doesn't say you must consider the factors, but it says you should. When you exercise your discretion, you should consider these six factors. State v. Moriwaki is a governing standard on these types of dismissals in this jurisdiction. It is not broken, it is not deficient, it is not necessary to go outside the jurisdiction and go to New Mexico or Vermont and add some separation of powers gloss onto our existing framework. The IC majority purports to use the statement, the separation of powers gloss to emphasize the public interest in prosecuting crime. This case is not about taking power away from the state. The issue at hand is judicial discretion. What standard of deference does the appellate court give to the trial court's considered thoughtful and careful exercise of discretion? Did the trial court appropriately apply the discretion and balance the factors or not? Even though a reviewing court might disagree with how a trial court assessed a certain factor, ultimately concluded which way a factor should cut for or against retrial, that does not rise to the level of abuse of discretion. The separation of powers terminology the IC majority uses is like a red herring. It's diversionary language that takes away Our focus, the focus should be on whether the trial court abused its discretion. Resorting to this language is confuses the issue at hand, and in effect, it chips away at the scope of judicial power conferred to the trial courts as defined in State versus Moriwaki. Now, the out-of-state jurisdiction cases that the ICA majority relied on, the case of State versus Salvi from Vermont and the case of State versus Gonzalez from New Mexico, each of these cases, those respective jurisdictions adopted their own framework, very similar to Moriwaki, but our framework contains a definition of the court's first attempt to define in broad terms what the judicial power is. And that similar kind of statement is not found in the Vermont or New Mexico Supreme Court decision. Yes?
Assuming that we adhere to your suggestion to embrace more law, did the trial court err in its assessment of the facts of this case?
I'll go to the second portion to address Justice Nakayama's concern. We feel that the trial court did not err, that the discretion exercised here was appropriately within the scope of Moriwaki.
And didn't the trial judge say that he should be taking into consideration the strength of the case?
Yes.
Is that fair?
It is the trial court's reason, the specific reason the trial court stated, well, I'm not going to give my evaluation because, I think he said it was because of his reading of Lincoln. And as we say in the application, that reading of Lincoln, we agree with the IC majority. Lincoln doesn't preclude the trial court from doing that. However, the fact that the trial court didn't do necessarily that part of that specific factor, we submit, does not mean that discretion was inappropriately exercised here. The fact that the court downplayed its own evaluation and felt that it didn't matter, in fact, we would suggest that that conveys the great respect the trial court had for the jury's, the province of the jury here. The court, in making those comments, was circumspect about not overreaching what the jury was trying to do, and it shows how the court was really trying to do the analysis required in Moriwaki.
Didn't the court say something about if he did take into consideration the strength of the case, it would have been for a retrial?
I have to pull out the transcript and look. There may have been something that sounded that way. But that's just, we submit that there was no specific finding or conclusion on that factor. And that's trial court's evaluation and relative case. That's one factor. And then Moriwaki says you should consider six factors. And the trial court went through all the rest. So when he did that, he went through all the rest, another key significant factor that kind of counterbalances against his not doing the evaluation is that he said if there's a do-over, if we do it again, there wouldn't be a significant difference with the retrial. And we feel that that's a very significant factor, because that cuts directly to the heart of fairness to the defendant and also to the court's integrity of the judicial process. That's the court's interest. So,
yes. In any event, the court found relative strength to support having a retrial, didn't it?
I believe overall the court said it was a credibility case and that, yes, I was.
Order.
Yes.
It's written order.
Yes.
It excluded that as a basis for dismissal.
Yes.
That factor. Given it must have decided that relative strength would be the retrial side of the damage.
Yes.
Was the trial court's reading of Lincoln incorrect?
To the extent trial court says something to that effect of, I don't think it's my place to be doing that, or something to that effect. The trial court seemed to read Lincoln to preclude that kind of assessment, but and the ICA majority recognized that Lincoln is a different case, and all Lincoln did was borrow the very nice framework that Moriwaki sets up, must balance the three interests. And in Lincoln, which was not a hung jury mistrial case, they just used that portion of the analysis and they said, no, the balance was done here, and in Lincoln, the trial court in Lincoln did not appropriately give deference to this court's mandate that there be a third trial. And
so Lincoln was different.
Yeah, Lincoln was completely different.
I think the prosecution seizes on some language in Lincoln about the trial court should balance the evidence. But that was the trial court balancing the evidence, not after a hung jury, but after the case had been remanded to the trial court for a new trial.
Right.
And before the trial had even proceeded.
Right.
So that the Supreme Court of Lincoln spent a lot of time telling the trial court, said, when it says you are to have a new trial, that means you are to have a new trial,
yes,
and not to determine evidence, the way of evidence, before you have the new trial.
Right.
So Lincoln even apply it?
I don't think so. The Lincoln, they didn't even go through the six factors because they weren't really applying the Moriwaki framework because it wasn't a hung jury mistrial at issue in Lincoln. So they only, the ICA majority relies on that portion of dicta, and I call it dicta in Lincoln because Lincoln is not procedurally a very different case. So it's not really even a Moriwaki case.
But it doesn't matter to you, does it?
No, because this case can be resolved just under Moriwaki. Lincoln doesn't apply here.
Oh, the trial court found that we don't decide a new trial.
The trial court's evaluation of case.
And the defendant didn't take the cross appeal of that issue.
No. Yes.
In considering the likelihood of any substantial difference, what's your understanding is what could be the difference? What would the prosecutor have done differently?
They've made a lot of argument about we could have done this differently, we could have done that differently, we could go get this and that new evidence. But as the trial court appropriately recognized, a second trial is not an opportunity to correct any mistakes that may have been made in the first trial. So, everybody did their jobs. The trial courts found professional conduct and diligence was good, but that doesn't mean you get a retrial.
There was some discussion about the jury was confused. Both the ICA and the trial court indicated that. And the prosecution indicated that it would call a witness, and that witness would be a new trial. It would testify to the definition of genitalia. To clarify that, because there was a real problem, apparently, for the jury to set up a question. Wouldn't that have made a difference? It would have alleviated confusion.
I mean, it may, but respectfully, and I think that goes afield of the narrow scope of review that the trial court needs to engage in. And here's how I would address that specific point. If the jury was confused, that's all the prosecution could have adequately had all the tools of trial to correct any confusion that the jury may have had. The government could have laid their case out more clearly. Closing argument is the most effective tool to clear up any confusion, skipping around the evidence, genitalia, what it means. I mean, that's their opportunity to make things crystal clear to the jury. And that was their opportunity to clear up any potential confusion. That's their golden opportunity to clear it all up. And you don't blame it on the jury or say, oh, the jury was confused, and say that that entitles you to a do-over. And you know, we infer that the jury may have been confused based on jury communications, which feels very problematic, because the jury communications, the meaning behind each jury communication is in the eye of the beholder. Any party can read anything they want into a jury communication. We're assuming that the jury was confused based on the kind of communications we saw coming out. But we don't know how many jurors were behind that particular communication. It seems that way, that was the consensus, that there may have been confusion.
So the subsequent trial and prosecution in the case, confusion would be cleared up. What about additional evidence?
It wasn't even clear that the additional evidence was even admissible. I think the trial court even found that, I think, evidence of, you know, if we had the video. It's very speculative. If you were able to get the video, if it exists, the defendant allegedly playing with himself. Number one, you don't even know if it exists. We don't even know if they can get it. And if they got it, whether they could properly admit it. There's all these ifs. And so to compel a defendant to undergo a new trial based on...
You're focusing on the videotape, which was one for Jack Porter, bringing it to himself.
Yes, that came up in cross-examination.
So the evidence that there was a videotape that showed him playing with himself was contestable. And the prosecution indicated that the tape at the subsequent trial would be admitted as additional evidence. Is that right?
I think the prosecutor conceded that they weren't sure whether they could admit the tape. The reference to the tape came out very inadvertent, and it was the defense who actually inadvertently opened that door. It came out in cross-examination by the defense counsel, and I think in the beginning of the transcript hearing, she says, "Well, I'm certainly not no better to open better than to open that door next time around." So that's how we found out about the tape.
So as far as you're concerned, the tape was not caught. There was no tape.
There was no tape. It wasn't litigated. It just comes up during the trial, and then they're squabbling about it after. And it's based on if we find the tape, if it exists, if it actually shows this.
So as far as whether the new evidence or additional evidence would be admitted or not, there was, and that evidence would have been the tape. The tape had not been found as far as you know.
No.
So in terms of the question of admissibility, the subject matter had been admitted as to what was on the tape through the testimony of the witness.
It came out as a passing reference. It came out during cross-examination.
Is there any other additional evidence that the prosecution indicated would have been presented at the time?
I think they said they would try to find another witness who the complainant told her story to. I think that was it. But, you know, again, Your Honor, a retrial is not an opportunity for them to make their case better. We can always do a case better if we get another opportunity at retrial. But the point of my work is the fundamental interests are the integrity of the judicial process. We're going to have the judicial process do this trial over again. And it's a credibility contest. It's not likely to result in a different result. And then the second being a fundamental interest. And these two, the court's interest and the defendant's interest, are classified as fundamental interests.
It's not the same.
Yes.
Well, in fact, the court sort of seemed to be thinking out loud. So on the question of genitalia, the court said, well, in effect, we told them it was a common meaning, and the jury didn't come back and ask for any clarification of that.
Yes.
So the question of whether or not there was confusion was arguable in support. The truth never came back and asked for further clarification, but accepted what the court said.
Yes, I mean, the court said maybe they were confused, but there's no specific.
And the court also said, but then they could have come back and asked for clarification at the end.
The jury is presumed to have followed the court's instructions.
And as to the videotape, that was never produced in evidence.
Right.
The respondent never said it would produce it.
No.
And in fact, the respondent said it probably wouldn't get into the videotape,
yes,
because it was something that occurred in the past.
Yes.
The only reason the videotape came up is because defense counsel opened it up on cross examination.
She said she would not do it again.
The court noted that in this decision, that the whole issue would come up because it's unlikely that in a new trial the defense would bring out something like that again.
Sure, yes. Is that time off, sir?
What about the ICA? You know, Maury Watkins sets out six factors. The ICA, instead of applying the six factors, used a case out of Vermont and a case out of New Mexico as a basis for their decision. Why didn't the ICA apply Maury Watkins rather than go outside of the state to decisions that don't apply in this state?
I don't know, Your Honor. When I read the ICA majority's opinion, it was rather stunning that they felt the need to go outside the jurisdiction when our framework.
Did anyone cite you or the prosecution to Suave or Gonzalez?
No. And the prosecution has never argued separation of powers or anything else. They feel they should win under state versus Maury Watkins as is. And so the cases, those two cases, are completely distinct.
Is the ICA defined by Maury Watkins?
Yes, they are. And especially in light of the fact that neither side urged anything beyond a Maury Watkins-like framework.
Well, the ICA sets up two different tests. It says only in rare and unusual cases can the court dismiss. And that comes out of Suave, doesn't it?
Yes.
And then it says only in the most extreme of cases can the court dismiss.
Yes.
Citing Gonzalez.
Yes. This language.
Does any of that language or standard state it in Maury Watkins?
All the phrases.
How does the ICA set up these two different standards in two cases outside of this jurisdiction and then says analyzing these principles here after referring to these two cases? How did they get to that point?
They take that dicta from Lincoln and then they bring in Vermont and New Mexico language, and they use that language, those portions of the opinion that talk about the power to dismiss is sparingly used. Discretion is not necessarily limited. The court should dismiss only in rare and unusual cases where compelling circumstances exist. Quote, limited and exercised with great caution, end quote. That quote may dismiss only in the most extreme.
If there is refer specifically to those two cases and say, applying these principles here, and cite these two standards, neither of which is fine or blocking. Is that an error of law?
Yes. Yes, it is. It conflicts with Maury Watkins, which does not, there's nothing in Maury Watkins that says the judicial power to dismiss should be so narrow or circumscribed in this manner.
Well, in the most extreme of cases, is a direct quote out of the New Mexico case. Apparently applies in New Mexico. Is that in the word of law?
No. It's not.
Did ICA seem to get to that language as a result of separation of powers?
seems like they felt that there needed to be more deference to the prosecution, and that the existing framework didn't do that enough. But in trying to do that, they actually, my time is about to go, but in doing that, they are trying to elevate the strong interest of the state in prosecuting crime to the level of a fundamental interest. And then Moriwaki says, the society's interest is strong, but the fundamental interest of the court and of fairness to the defendant, that the discretion of the prosecutor must necessarily defer to those fundamental interests. So they're trying to elevate the state's interest to the level of fundamental interest of the other two. But that's not how Moriwaki works. And since I'm out of time, may I conclude and save the rest of my argument for rebuttal?
I'd like to tackle that separation of power issue first, if I may. My take on it is quite a bit different. Initially, the ICA and its SDO set out a Moriwaki test, analysis, parameters, whatever you want to call it. It's what the trial courts have to follow in this state. It then referred to Lincoln and said, which was stood for the proposition that courts don't have a broad power in dismissing hung juries, but they are circumspect, and they must do so within the parameters of Moriwaki. And then the court continued and said, indeed, other courts have found that where the court doesn't exercise caution and doesn't exercise its sparing discretion, it implicates separation of power concerns. I think all the court was saying was, be circumspect in your analysis and in dismissing hung juries. I don't think they're crafting out a new test at all. Because thereafter.
So, are you indicating that the separation of powers factor is subsumed in the factors that Moriwaki give some difference to the process?
Generally, sure. Yeah, because it means exercise your caution. Be cautious and be circumspect and be sparing in your decisions to dismiss a case after a hung jury. I think that's it. Because then, thereafter, the court, applying these principles, Your Honor, they said that in their opinion, but it focused entirely upon the Moriwaki analysis thereafter and dismissed.
Well, you've been cited to slide.
Yeah, I know. And, I didn't argue this. I don't do the separation part thing. I rely strictly upon Moriwaki analysis because that's the law of this jurisdiction.
Why cite Gonzales?
Just as an aside, I think.
Why? Moriwaki sets it out. Nobody argues these two cases.
No, I don't know why. I can't say that. But my main concern is that the lower court here clearly abused its discretion because it disregarded reason. It disregarded the principles of law as set out in Moriwaki. This court was flat out wrong in dismissing the case. First, it said that the offense wasn't serious. This is a Class C felon punished by 5 years in jail. If he's convicted, he has to register as a sex offender. It's constitutionally serious. He has the right to a jury trial. This is, and the nature of the offense, we've got a grandfather, a surrogate grandfather, touching, rubbing this 13-year-old girl's genitalia with his fingers. This is serious. And the court, inexplicably,
with his fingers?
With his fingers, I think, entwined. And then, she doesn't know how it got down to her crotch area, but all of a sudden he's rubbing her genitalia with his fingers. That wasn't her testimony.
Was there a, questions that were asked by the jurors in regards to the genitalia?
No.
In the question that was asked by the jurors to the court during the deliberation, was there a explanation of the hand, back of the hand,
yes,
it's not the fingers that were. You characterize him, the defendant, as being a sexual predator. What was the evidence which indicated that he was a sexual predator?
Well,
besides the touching of the genitalia or the pubic hairs with the hand.
I would think.
And they don't understand the
think the argument was that he was actually courting this girl, this child, by showing her DVDs in the back, asking her to sit on his lap after watching a DVD of people having intercourse, asking her to flash her dress, you know, after he fondled her, touched her. I think that's...
Do you agree that this was a case of credibility between the complainant and the defendant?
It wasn't the classic case of credibility, Your Honor, where it's one-on-one. We had an additional factor where our investigator testified that the defendant's former girlfriend, the grandmother of the minor victim, testified that he didn't intend to do it when he touched her. So we have that added ingredient.
How was the indicated evidence portraying him as indicated that he was a sexual predator? What about the complaint? What did the evidence indicate the kind of person she was?
Young. I'm not sure otherwise than that. She was just a young child.
I'm looking at the credibility aspect of the case. How was she portrayed?
She was portrayed as an innocent victim. And I think the court, in its analysis, found that to be strong in favor of retrial. The strength of the evidence must have related to her credibility.
Versus indicate that she was a good student, she was a respectful child, she listened to her parents.
I don't think there is.
What did the jury understand this complaining would be like in regards to weighing the credibility?
You know, I can't recall that. But as to the second Milwaukee factor, the number of mistrials and the circumstances of deliberation, there is one mistrial. It's only one. The circumstances of deliberation illustrates that this jury was out to lunch. I'm telling you, this is ridiculous. First of all, they couldn't understand what genitalia was. Then they asked, is the back of the hand against pubic hair touching? There was no evidence of that. There's only evidence he stroked her genitalia area, with her private parts, as she calls it, with his fingers. So how are they even getting there? And then, after deliberations, after the mistrial was granted, they wanted to know more about how much pressure was used when he touched her. So they thought that he touched her. They weren't even following the law. And moreover, they couldn't even remember the evidence. They asked for transcripts in a 2-day trial, a short, not complex trial. They asked for transcripts so they could figure out what they didn't really recall.
Mr. Anderson, in all fairness, could there be a disagreement as to what the testimony was? It wasn't necessarily that the entire jury didn't remember what happened.
Yes, okay.
Let me ask you one other thing. Do you think the ICA gravely erred in importing a separation of powers aspect onto the Milwaukee test?
I think that's not the balance. That's not that part of the Milwaukee test. I don't think they gravely erred because what they were saying, underscoring, was a principle of caution, use sparingly. That's what I see it in the context of.
Did Milwaukee say that it the discretion?
No, they never said that.
Then why wouldn't it be error for the ICA to report those cautionary warnings?
No, and I'm okay with that. You know, if you guys want to let the ICA know this is not part of the test, that's fine with me. I'm just thinking I should win hands down on a Milwaukee test because every single factor pays for retrial. Every single factor in the court's own evaluation of the evidence, and then the last part where it says that the conduct and diligence of the prosecutor, of counsel, particularly that of the prosecuting attorney, that means to me the prosecutor, it would weigh against it if the prosecutor engaged in misconduct or didn't present his case diligently. Well, none of that occurred, but the court nonetheless found it weighed against retrial. Now, how does that figure? I don't think that's right at all. Right? So I think the seriousness of the defense. Only one trial, the confusion of the jury, the likelihood of another, because of the confusion of the jury, that dovetails with the likelihood of another result. You know, the same evidence would essentially be presented, I think, basically. I would think. And then the court's evaluation of relative strength of the evidence, and the final issue about the conduct and diligence of counsel, they all wait for us. Because I think the jury would be more cognizant and follow the law more clearly. To me, at least, you can say that they disagreed about what was testified to. But there are questions that after the trial, how we want to know if there's enough pressure, you know?
I mean, generally speaking, why would the same, say not even in this case, why would the same evidence be presented in the subsequent trial way for your prosecution?
Because I think we have a better jury. I think we have a more fair jury. I don't think either court received a fair shake at this trial. I don't think the interest of judicial integrity, the fairness to the defense, or society's interest in prosecuting offenses, none of them were served because of this jury.
You know, juries ask all kinds of questions. Many times you can't discern, as a trial judge, I couldn't discern why jurors ask certain questions. Sometimes after you talk to the jurors, you know, surprising, reasons come up, but not necessarily reasons indicating the confusion or the failure of the jury to follow their obligation. But I don't see any problem with them asking about their particular. I mean, that's, I think, you know, that's part of the whole issue. The thing about pressure, too, is a problem because, you know, there is a state of mind requirement, and the question of whether or not or how the touching took place may go to the state of mind. You don't obviously have circumstantial evidence.
What about the weight of the hand? The
heavy, whether there's pressure or not, may go to whether it's inadvertent or not.
No, but what about the back of the hand on the pubic here? That wasn't even that issue.
That's what I meant when I said sometimes they ask questions. And it may not even be the whole jury, it may just be one juror who had some kind of question like that. But under Moriwaki, the whole idea of separation of powers is incorporated in that test, isn't it?
Okay, I'll go along with that, because it's a balancing between those three interests, sure. I think the court said, considering we have A and B felonies in here, and C ranks pretty low, and I didn't see any physical injury to the victim. But
you don't argue with that analysis, right?
You know, I have to, because I don't think it's a global comparison. I think it's a case-by-case basis as to if it's the severity of the offense. And it doesn't say compare it to a misdemeanor or anything like that. I'm sure that can come into play. But this was a Class C felony, and the nature of the offense was a sexual assault. To me, that's serious. You know, and I'm surprised that the court wouldn't find otherwise, actually, you know, Judge Perkins, you know, to tell you the truth. And it seems like both the defense and even the dissent in this case think that once the court exercises its discretion, it's inviolate. But it's not inviolate, because that's why we have Moriwaki, these parameters tell us if the court, you know, properly exercised its discretion. And here it didn't. It just didn't, you know?
Well, one thing. As far as the video to be involved, the defendant making of himself, does the prosecution have to be?
No, I've never even heard of that. I mean, other after this trial. No, sir.
What do you make of 8-4 for a
criminal? that's very interesting. I think, you know, my bent is the jury was out to lunch, like I told you. And Judge Perkins himself said, you know, it was probably more 6-6, you know, at one time, because they indicated there two were going back and forth. So, you know, so.
Well, you know, I understand your position, and maybe it is a question. But Judge Perkins was there, he saw the jury, he saw counsel, and he did a very good job. And he saw the witnesses, and he said that this case should be tried again. We're not there. We weren't there to see the jurors and the witnesses at trial. So isn't that one reason why we should defer?
No, I think we should defer. No, no. Because he also said the case was strong enough to warrant retrial. That was pretty interesting for him to say that. And he also, you know, so no.
Were not, we would have a lot more precedent on the specific types of cases to draw from than just Moriwaki and the dicta in Lincoln. So the IC's concern by bringing this in from other jurisdictions that the doctrine, Moriwaki doctrine, is maybe used routinely or too often, that concern is unfounded.
Ms. Nakasoli, as a matter of fact, don't we generally defer to this court's discretion when the court doesn't dismiss and it comes up on appeal?
Yes. Yes. And in fact, you know, the prosecution comes up and they've made a valiant effort trying to say that the trial court didn't consider this factor enough, or the jury was confused and all these things, but the trial court methodically went through the six factors. They were constantly balancing the three interests, and he conscientiously exercised his discretion. I need to just bring up the side point because I think it's very important. The investigator's statement regarding what the defendant said to the grandmother, I believe we argued this in the opening brief. They cannot be standing up here saying that what it sounded like, maybe he made an admission to the complainant's grandmother. That was admitted for impeachment purposes only. So they can't come up here and say that should be used as substantive evidence, and that's that argument that was made, it sounded to me like it was being used improperly when it was admitted only for impeachment, not for the truth of what was said. Now, the whole argument that this is a case about a sexual predator, the defendant is presumed innocent until convicted, and 12 jurors had to unanimously agree on that. And here, 8-4 said not guilty. The severity of the offense, this is a First Circuit Court on Oahu, they have 100 to 200 cases per criminal trial judge, and they are all felonies. So everything, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. Everything is severe. And all Oahu requires that the trial court consider the severity, and the trial court did that.
Under Oahu, is the trial judge required to weigh each factor equally, or may the trial court
they are free to do that. It doesn't circumscribe or micromanage how they do the analysis. It just says, in order for you to properly exercise discretion, you should go through these six factors. And this court tried to go through all of them. Now, regarding the number of trials, there's only one trial here. But when you look at Moriwaki, there's nothing specific about one trial, mandating the case for dismissal is very weak after only one trial. There's nothing specific about that. The only thing specific in terms of number that Moriwaki says is that strong consideration should be given to dismissal after two hung juries. So after two, it doesn't say even it's automatic. After two hung juries, strong consideration should be given to dismissal. That's the closest they get to putting a number. And then they don't even say it's automatic dismissal after two trials. They say, so, you know, you could have three or more. You You could have dismissal after one. It leaves it to the trial court's discretion. The first trial is not a trial run. So if the jury, if they perceive that the jury was not fair or the jury was confused, you know, maybe it's because the jury had a reasonable doubt. All this asking for the transcripts, confusion about what this or that witness said, you know, to the defense, that sounds a lot like they, at least eight of them, had enough reasonable doubt that they could not unanimously agree to convict this defendant. So if we're going to rely on jury confusion as divined from jury communications, when the appellate court is not there, the appellate court was not there, didn't see the witnesses, didn't hear the evidence, you know, that converts first trial into a trial run, and that does not promote the integrity of the judicial process. Both sides agree regarding what the applicable law is and that it really was not necessary to go outside the jurisdiction. So that is meant that shows this court how off base the Eisenman majority's analysis was when it went outside. And I'd like to just close with this as I noticed that I'm out of time. It is significant that this argument falls on February 19th. February 19th is the 67th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. That experience represents gross overreaching by the executive branch and led to one of the darkest moments in our nation's constitutional history. It underscores the fundamental importance of the power of judicial review, because the only entity that can protect the individual from the enormous power of the state is the court. That is what Moriwaki is about, the court's power to administer justice. The IC majority's opinion erodes this important power and creates a chilling effect on the trial courts whenever they exercise their discretion against the wishes of the government. Principius obstet et finem res bis. We urge this court to issue a clear, strong reassertion and reaffirmation of the judicial power in the state of Moriwaki and the scope of that power under Article 6 of the Hawaii Constitution. Thank you.
Please rise. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii stands adjourned until further notice.